Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. This is Ken Brown on our Ken Brown Afternoon Financial Report. Tonight, again, a topic of major importance to all of us, both from a consumption standpoint as consumers, but then again, as investors, we're clearly interested in this area of energy and how our capital can be best placed in this particular sector. We have a special guest tonight, Chris Nelder. He's a senior analyst with Energy and Capital, and also he participates in GreenChips.com, looking for investment opportunities in this wide open field of energy. Let's go to our very special guest tonight, Chris Nelder. He's an editor and energy consultant, even a solar designer, and he's a publisher of Once the Green Zine, Better World type publications. He's with us tonight for this broadcast on focusing in on our current positions in energy, alternatives, ethanol, and a host of subjects and matters within this topic. So let's go to our special guest, Chris Nelder. Chris, how are you this evening?
Very good. Thanks for having me.
Oh, you're quite welcome. Here we are in the midst of this second half of the year. We've got characters like Hugo Chavez and the Iranian president being photographed together on energy deals and conspiracies of all types of thought processes as to against the U.S. And here we have oil now above 72 dollars a barrel in that area. What's this future of our energy predicament, crisis? Or what do you forecast here as to our current position?
Predicament and crisis are good words. I think that's an appropriate choice. Essentially, I don't know if your listeners know too much about the peak oil theory, but essentially we're approaching, if we're not already there, a situation where global oil supply is about maxed out and about to begin a decline. Just to put aside a misunderstanding that's very common in this area, it's not about oil running out. In fact, we're only at about the halfway point of global oil production. It's about the flow rate. It's about the rate at which we can produce that oil. And the world economies are all dependent on ever-increasing growth, which in turn depends on ever-increasing amounts of energy, mainly from oil. So we're about to enter a time when we have to start living with less and less energy each year instead of more and more. And the kinds of geopolitical maneuverings that are happening in oil-producing states like Venezuela are essentially reflections of that situation. It means that the remaining oil is only going to become more valuable every year, and those who have it are every year in more and more of a position to dictate the terms under which that oil will be produced and who will get the profits. And that's essentially what Hugo Chavez is doing right now.
You were put in a position to have an opportunity to take us from this crisis or this difficult quagmire that we're in. How would you resolve the issues that we currently face?
Well, that's a great question, and I think that's what many of the best minds in the world are intently focused on answering right now.
It's why we have you with us tonight.
Well,
give us some guidance.
Yes, well, we all have to pitch in. First of all, I think it's important that people understand that, at least in my estimation, given the research and the study that I've done, I don't believe that there are any supply-side solutions to the situation that we find ourselves in now. It's not about producing more energy from something else. It's about reducing our demand for energy. That's, as far as I'm concerned, and as far as a lot of other observers I respect are concerned, and here I'm talking about former heads of the CIA, former Energy Department, high-ranking officials, and so on. And the former heads of and current heads of big oil companies have all said, going forward, the name of the game is reducing demand. So, we can and we will do a great deal to try to produce more energy from renewable energy sources, which is what I'm a big champion of renewable energy. That's why I got into solar. I fully support wind. cellulosic ethanol and things of that kind that give us alternatives to oil and natural gas. But bottom line, we can't produce enough of those alternatives to make up, to compensate for the loss of energy that we'll experience from oil and gas due to their, you know, natural peaking of production.
One of the things that seems so somewhat confusing is that oil demand since 1980 really has only increased by 2 to 3 or maybe 3.5%.
I'm not sure what you mean by that.
Well, how much does it go up annually, our oil demand?
About 1.5% every year.
Okay, so 1.5%. You mean to tell me that these other areas can't pick up 1.5% per year?
It's not about that. It's about that plus depletion. So, you know, the overall energy demand as our economies grow is increasing about 1.5% a year. But at the same time, once we pass the peak, we're actually losing about 2.5% a year of production.
So in other words, we're looking at this thing like a mountaintop, and we're climbing the top. We're going at 1.5% per year now, but we're depleting, and eventually we top out, and on the downside, we get much quicker, like a margin call effect on the downside.
Yes, except that you're hiking in sand the whole time. So as you try to hike up another 1.5 steps every year, you're also sliding back 2.5 steps, and you know once you pass the peak. So really what it is we have an exponential increase in energy demand, and we have an exponential decrease in energy supply going on simultaneously. So all these other alternatives, and then I'm including ethanol, nuclear, pretty much everything you can imagine, can't really make up for the amount of depletion that we're talking about. The alternatives will give us some additional supply, which will help to buy us essentially more time as we're waiting for oil depletion to continue to set in. But
well, the program seems
to allow us to continue to increase demand.
Okay, the two programs that seemingly are in front of Congress at this point is increasing the miles per gallon for automobiles by 2018 or 2020.
Yep.
And the other is to somehow put a tax on oil profits or excess profits, whatever that determination is, to somehow create an energy program. What's your thought about fuel conservation in terms of increasing gas mileage? And the other thing is this somehow taxing excess profits for alternative sources.
Well, increasing CAFE standards, in my opinion, is just an absolute no-brainer. I mean, we haven't done anything on increasing CAFE standards in this country in a long time. I don't remember exactly the date. I think it's about 20 years. So, you know, and the rest of the world, particularly Europe, where gas prices are considerably higher, have already done this. I mean, they're already running a vehicle fleet in Europe that gets an average fuel economy that's about twice that of the average fuel economy in the U.S.
And what'd they do?
Well, they did it by using smaller vehicles, by making those vehicles more efficient, by concentrating their engineering talent and resources on making fuel-efficient vehicles instead of concentrating on making bigger and more powerful vehicles, which is what we've done in the U.S.
Well, aren't they?
So it's really just a matter of different priorities.
Aren't they using a greater emphasis of diesel?
Yes, they are. Most far more of their vehicles are diesel.
Okay, so really, it's a change towards a different fuel burning type rather than the gasoline that we use. It was really more of the more energy efficient diesel orientation, right?
Well, yes, but you can do more energy efficient gasoline burning engines as well. It's really not. The difference in efficiency is not due to the difference in the fuel.
There's a
difference in the design.
I don't know. I want to go back to the 60s when I had my GTO and my Le Mans and all the best, big, fast.
I used to have one of those old Le Mans 1970 myself. Love that car.
Oh, I'm telling you. You know, I got a greater feeling of security in my automobile. You get a lighter, smaller, flimsier vehicle. Aren't we going to increase accident, traffic fatalities and casualties and go off the graph with
Yeah. Well, again, I think we can just look at the European example, and we find that that's not the case. I mean, originally, as the U.S. begins to make a similar transition and move towards smaller, lighter, more fuel-efficient vehicles, yes, there will be a disparity there where some of those drivers are going to be up against, you know, Escalades and Expeditions and things like that. But, you know, there will be a period of transition where we have this strange mix of vehicles on the road. But I think the trend toward more fuel-efficient vehicles is absolutely inevitable. There's no way around that. And our current emphasis on these giant SUVs that, you know, get under 15 miles to the gallon, I'll make a prediction right now that in 5 years we're going to look back on that and just go, man, how stupid was that? What were we thinking? But this brings me to my next point. That's exactly how I feel about this bill saying that we're going to tax the oil companies for excessive profits. Colossally stupid maneuver. First of all, it's a very badly defined bill, so we haven't really defined what we think excessive profits are or what we think profiteering constitutes. You know, when you look at the profitability of the oil business relative to the profitability of all kinds of other businesses, retail, manufacturing, you name it, it's not like their profits are out of line. And if you look back at the history of the oil business over the last, you know, 30, 40 years, up until most recent history, the oil business was sucking wind. They were having a very difficult time making any profits at all. It was completely on the out of favor in the investing world. And, you know, the oil companies are basically trying to figure out how they were going to survive. So we've had a radical shift in the valuation of oil over the last 5 or 6 years because we're now approaching this point where supply and demand are in a very tight balance, which they were not historically. And if we want that situation to be corrected, if we want to be able to have a little more slack between supply and demand, what we really need is for oil companies to not only continue investing in drilling and production of new oil, but we also need them to start putting an emphasis on alternatives like ethanol and to start putting their money and their talent and their infrastructure to work on alternatives to oil-based fuels. And if we start trying to attack them every time they go out and try to make a buck doing this stuff, they're not going to be willing to do it, and that's only going to make the problem worse. So I think it was a colossally stupid bill. It was clearly only for the assuagement of constituents who thought that they were going to feel better if that got passed. It's really just simply a reflection that people in Congress and in the public really don't understand the energy business. They don't understand how it works. They don't understand what the alternatives are, and they don't understand what the profit picture really looks like.
Well, certainly energy is used for every factor of production and for transportation. How do you break it down in terms of a game plan from a standpoint of investment-oriented priorities or hierarchies for profit? How do you see the best use of one's money as an investor?
Yeah, boy, you know, to an extent, it's almost like shooting fish in a barrel right now. You know, take your pick. Personally, I've been long on the independent heavy sour crude refiners, Valero and Tesoro, for a long time. I think that's a great business to invest in, primarily because we're past the peak of light sweet crude globally as of 2005, and as we go forward, the remaining oil that's left gets heavier and sourer. And in order to refine that oil into usable transportation fuels and whatnot, we need to refine it in what's called a complex refinery as opposed to the simple refineries that are used to process light sweet crude. And so the emphasis on heavy sour crude refining gets greater and greater with every single year as the supply of light sweet goes into decline and we find ourselves relying more and more heavily on heavy sour. So I really like Valero and Tesoro, at least until Saudi Arabia and some of the other producers in the Middle East have got their own heavy sour complex refineries up and running. I also think if you time your investments well, ethanol can be a good play. The Andersons, the biggest ethanol play in the U.S., just announced blowout earnings on June 20th, and the stock popped, I don't know what it was, 12% in a day or something like that. So, this, you know, if you time it right, those can be good directions to go as well.
Which company was that?
The Andersons, A-N-D-E, is the ticker. Pacific Ethanol is staging a comeback right now. From, you know, basically the whole sector was sold off and kind of out of favor in the last couple of months after its huge run up in the spring, up through the spring, I should say. But they seem to be coming back into favor now, primarily because we have this bill in Congress that we're going to increase our ethanol production domestically sevenfold, up to 36 billion gallons by 2022. I don't know. I haven't had a chance yet this morning to see where that bill stands. Last I knew it was in a House committee. I think it's before the Senate now as well. But it seems likely that'll be passed if it hasn't already. And if that's the case, you know, it's boom times for domestic ethanol. I mean, come on, a sevenfold increase by 2022, that's huge. So, you know, Pacific Ethanol, Verisun Energy, Aventine Renewable Energy Holdings, the Andersons, you know, Magpie, MGPI is a grain producer, STKL is a grain producer and processor. All these kinds of stocks are going to do well on this ethanol boom. But that ethanol boom is going to take a period of years. However, you have to watch your timing carefully because it's a hot sector. It rapidly becomes in favor and it rapidly becomes out of favor. So you have to watch the big money flow and play it carefully. As far as other ways to play the whole situation, solar obviously is a long term bull market that in my opinion is just getting started. Again, there are some safe plays and there are some risky plays and timing matters. The one that seems to be immune, however, to all ups and downs in the rest of the sector is First Solar, FSLR. I have no idea why their production is, why their performance is so outstanding, but it just seems like they can do no wrong. And you know, likewise, wind energy is a good place to invest. And my personal favorite at this point, in terms of renewable energies, is geothermal. You know, it's been completely off the radar for years and years. No one's been paying any attention to it, and in fact, it probably has the greatest untapped resource available. You know, enormous properties that haven't even begun to be tapped for their potential. And a rapidly developing technology as well that's taking formerly unusable geothermal prospects and making useful energy out of them now, thanks to the development of things like the binary cycle Rankine engine. So I think it's just a fascinating array of opportunities right down the line. You know, I mean, there's even a good case to be made for investing in coal and investing in natural gas as well as oil plays, because all of these things are having to take up more and more of the slack as we lose more and more of our current oil production. So again, I mean, it's really like shooting fish in a barrel. You know, obviously, with all investments, you have to watch your timings carefully. You have to watch your cycles, especially on a commodity. But I think it's, you know, it's a long-term bull market for all those things, at least until we get to the point where energy demand starts to fall apart because prices have gotten so high that we simply stop making things, stop going places, and stop buying stuff.
Well, would you have any favorites in this binary cycle engine manufacturers or this geothermal area or coal or natural gas?
Ormat Technologies is one of the big geothermal producers.
Ormat, you said?
Ormat, yeah. Their ticker is ORA. So I think that's a good choice. I like U.S. Geothermal. It's a really small stock, UGTH, but I think it's got a great long-term future. And Razor Technologies, ticker RZ, is a producer of these geothermal engines, manufacturer of these engines, and a co-producer of some of these projects. And, you know, they all seem to have a great future ahead of them. And actually, another interesting perspective is carbon trading. This is something we've talked about quite a bit at greenchipstocks.com, one of our sister publications, is how do you profit from carbon trading? And the Calgon Carbon Group, ticker CCC, is now making a market in carbon trading, and I think it's a great stock. It's up 5.5% on the day right now.
Okay. Carbon trading. I have not heard of that term before.
Okay. Well, carbon trading is where we're basically assigning the value of carbon credits to renewable energy technologies like solar and wind that don't generate any CO2 emissions. And we're saying, okay, the value of the energy that you've produced without creating CO2 can be traded to other energy producers who do create CO2. So we allow, for example, a coal plant, which generates an enormous amount of CO2, to buy carbon credits from, say, a big wind producer who generates no CO2. And in doing so, in making a market in carbon credits, we can encourage the development of no carbon producing technologies, and we can encourage the phasing out of heavy carbon producing technologies. So it's a market-based approach to dealing with global warming, essentially. And I think it's very smart. You know, there's also been a lot of discussion about applying carbon taxes across the entire economy. And obviously it's an extremely unpopular idea with utility sector, with most people in the energy generation side. But in my view, it makes more sense than just about any other approach. I mean, you can apply a carbon tax across the economy and eliminate all the other weird subsidies and tariffs and so on that essentially pervert the market mechanisms that would allow it to choose good energy and let it run. And it will magically, in a matter of decades, transform us from a heavy carbon-dependent culture to one that preferentially chooses renewable technologies that don't generate carbon.
Well, quite interesting. I guess there'll be more about that later on. I haven't seen much about that, but that's an interesting thought.
It's definitely a new and emerging area.
Let me take you to a different thought process. What if we did have an energy policy, which seems to go all the way back to the mid-70s, of being able to drill the AMWR, the Alaskan Natural Wildlife Reserve, or the Continental Shelf off the coasts of the U.S., how much change would you think that could have on the impact for alternatives or other fuel sources, or what would your general thought process be if suddenly if that became available, and would you advocate that it should become available?
I'm dead set against development of ANWR. It's really a fairly marginal amount of oil that's available up there. And as has been widely discussed, you know, there's a lot of environmental impact, not only in setting up facilities to produce that oil, but in getting it anywhere, the pipelines, distribution, all that stuff. It's in my view, it's far too much environmental expense for the value of the oil that we would get out of it. We would save more oil in this country by increasing the fleet efficiency of just the small and light-duty trucks in this country by 1.5 miles a gallon than we would by producing all of ANWR.
Okay.
So what's easier? I think it's obvious. It's far easier to turn out vehicles that get a little more juice out of their fuel than it is to go, you know, drilling some exotic projects like this that are enormously difficult and environmentally costly. Now, the Outer Continental Shelf, slightly different case. There's probably a good deal of energy that we could still produce out there. oil, but even more so natural gas. And I think it's probably inevitable that we will produce from the outer continental shelf more than we do now, which is essentially not at all. It's been in a moratorium situation. But the thing about that is that if you look at the big picture, where we're really going with energy supply and demand, and you take it out beyond just the next couple of years, you know, you look out, say, 20 years or 30 years, you find that we are inevitably approaching this peak and this decline. And then you have to ask yourself, well, what is the net effect of producing more supply now? The net effect is it allows us to continue business as usual for longer than we would otherwise. It allows us to continue to run a lot of vehicles that are getting far lower mileage than they could, and it allows us to increase our economic demands on oil more and more every year. And so once we get to the peak, we're actually at a greater overhang. We're actually at greater risk. We're farther out on that limb than we would have been had we not produced that additional oil and gas from the outer continental shelf. So it would be in our short-term best interest in terms of having, you know, lower prices for heating our homes and running our cars if we started producing that stuff today. But it would be absolutely against our long-term best interest to do that. What really makes more sense is to take a look at your total remaining resources, including the outer continental shelf, and say, how can we get the best use out of what's left? How can we consume this more slowly, make it last longer, and give us a little more time to make an adjustment to a future in which we're going to have less energy to live on every year rather than more? We're not even trying to make that adjustment now. It's a sacred cow to talk about economies that contract rather than expand. Absolutely a sacred cow. You know, if you even get to flat growth, it's called a depression, you know, let alone negative growth. So I think it's important that we kind of take the big picture in mind and say, you know, maybe we ought to start making some plans for the future here instead of just running around doing everything we can to produce every last bit of supply as quickly as we can in order to keep prices as low as we can. Let's look at the big picture and go, wait a minute, what we're really doing here is burning up the capital of the future. Let's try to make that last a little longer instead.
If we started calling atomic energy rather than nuclear energy, you think we get a little bit further of that with that progress? Isn't many of the countries like France and many of the European countries run maybe 50% or maybe even higher of their power grid needs from nuclear? If we would change the name and call it atomic energy, because I think right now we're below like 15 or 20% of our energy usage or power is created by atomic energy.
Changing the name would be wrong because in any case, whether they're doing it or we're doing it, we're talking about nuclear fission here. You know, it is nuclear energy. However, we can produce a great deal more nuclear energy than we do currently. You know, I don't believe we've built a new refinery in this country for at least 20 years, and we've got quite a few new refineries. Nuclear plants being planned, and they're currently, you know, trying to make their way through regulatory hurdles and so on. But is it a panacea? Not even hardly. In fact, I think that around the world, pretty much everyone has overestimated the potential of nuclear power. And the reason I believe that is because they're all assuming that the rate of use that we have today is going to continue into the future. They're not assuming that 10 other countries just like them are planning to radically increase their consumption of nuclear power. And if they all do it together, all of a sudden they found, whoa, that rate of consumption that we had in the past isn't even close to the rate of consumption that we have now. And all of a sudden that anticipated whatever it was, pick your number, 100-year supply, 50-year supply of nuclear energy suddenly contracts to about a 20-year supply. So so again, you know, and we find the same dynamic happening all around the energy wheel. You know, we have oil depletion setting in, and some countries start going into start switching their loads over to natural gas. Well, then what happens? The price of natural gas starts going up, starts increasing the price of grid electricity, and producers start switching over to coal. Well, then what happens? Well, then this alleged 250-year supply of coal that we have in this country, which, by the way, according to a new report, is nothing like that. It's maybe a 100-year supply. And everybody starts switching over to coal. All of a sudden, you've got a 20-year supply, 25-year supply of coal. So, you know, it's like a game of whack-a-mole. You know, you tamp one down, another one pops up. So this is why I believe that the real solutions, such as they are going forward, are in reducing demand, not increasing supply. And we will do everything that we can do to increase supply. We will build a lot more nuclear. We'll go absolutely crazy building ethanol refineries and producing as much ethanol as we can until it, you know, impacts us heavily in food prices. But will it solve our problems? No, I don't believe so. I believe that the best thing we can do is increase efficiency, because that's definitely the low-hanging fruit and the shortest path to reducing demand. And that's, again, why I fully support an increase in fuel economy standards.
Do you have any, in this peak oil theory, do you have any forecasts on the price of oil as you look ahead?
It's really a tough call. You know, there's so many variables to take into account. You know, if let's just say that we took the last 4 weeks and assumed that what happened in the last 4 weeks would more or less continue through the end of the year. I would say, yeah, you know, give it $80 a barrel by the end of the year, maybe 85. And that would strictly be on the basis of supply and demand and, you know, occasional fears about kidnappings in Nigeria. I just saw this morning that I believe it was a 5-year-old girl or a 3-year-old girl who is a daughter of one of the British petroleum workers over there was kidnapped by men, the radical group that's looking to emancipate the Niger Delta entirely from oil production. So, you know, these kinds of things will continue to add a fear premium into the price of barrel of oil. But and I think, you know, we would expect the recent trends to sort of continue along. However, give us another good hurricane like we had with Katrina and Rita. Oh, we could see $180 a barrel within a day, because the threat is so great and our supply and demand balance is so tight that it's really a matter of the margins. You know, when you're producing 85 million barrels a day and you're consuming 85 million barrels a day, and Saudi Arabia is the only country with any spare capacity, allegedly, a lot of people don't believe they really have that spare capacity. You take, 500,000 barrels a day off the market, it makes a big, big impact on the price. It's not linear at all. Everybody needs this stuff like lifeblood. So, you know, I think there's a lot of things out there which have the potential to be really disruptive, like hurricanes. And that could cause radical spikes in the price of oil, making it almost impossible to predict what the prices will be going forward.
Well, we've been in this position in the 70s. We've been here before.
We were in that position, 2 years ago when the hurricanes hit.
No, but I mean, we've been in this predicament of where to go with a policy, with crises, with difficulties in terms of seeing the future. With all the various variables, Mideast crisis, terrorists, political problems at home, we'd all know this. Solar energy was the thought process as being the cure-all and panacea for everything. After all, the sun is out all the time, except for when it's cloudy and rainy, like today here in South Florida. But anyhow, what went wrong with solar energy, geothermal, ethanol, methanol? All of those things were all the works of alternatives to solve the energy crisis of the 70s, and apparently it all fell by the wayside. What happened then, and why is this different?
Well, basically what happened is through geopolitical machinations, they drove the price of oil down by radically increasing supply. After the showdown that we had with Iran, when much of OPEC's oil was taken off the market, prices spiked. And that was the, incipient cause of all of our efforts to go big into solar and to go big into alternative energies and alcohol fuels and so on. But then what happened is, the Iranian hostage crisis was resolved. Saudi Arabia stepped back up and said, okay, we're going to now radically increase our production, which they did by, it was several fold. And they quickly drove the price of oil down so far that it no longer became economical to try to pursue these alternative energy technologies again. So basically, they manipulated the market and drove alternative technologies out.
So why can't we do that again? You said that. I just looked at a study.
The reason we can't do it again is because Saudi Arabia can't pull that trick off again.
Okay.
Because there's nobody else out there who can do it.
I was reading a little study here, you're our special guest with the insight, but I was reading something from the Interior Department of Minerals and Management,
mm-hmm.
and they said about the AMWAR and the Outer Continental Shelf that we would be able to reduce our imports by 13%. The AMWAR holds about 1.4 million barrels a day, 2,000 acres, 10 million barrels to possibly 16 million barrels of oil right there, and then over the Outer Continental Shelf, there's an additional 86 billion barrels, 3.5 times our current estimates, all told about 131 billion barrels and more than 1,000 trillion cubic feet of natural gas if we just went out there and looked at the low-hanging fruit and just took advantage of that.
Those resources.
If that's what happened in the 70s, all we did was pick up and produce more. Or find available supply, and it put all this other stuff with all the tax benefits, all the special incentives to develop all this stuff, and it all passed on because all they did was pick up and boost supply. Could it happen again?
No, and here's why. When Saudi Arabia boosted supply in order to drive the price of oil down, they did it with existing facilities. All they had to do was open the valve. What we're talking about here with producing more oil in the U.S., it's starting from scratch. So it takes years and years to go out and prospect, drill test wells, verify the results, start building rigs, which are in very short supply right now, by the way, worldwide, and commanding enormous rates. For their use, we've had a massive exodus of drilling rigs from the United States and Canada over the last 2 years or so. They're all getting called away to the Middle East and to Africa and to parts of Russia, places where there's still quite a bit more oil that can be developed. So, and we've also got at the same time as a shortage of equipment, we've got rapidly increasing prices, and we've got a shortage of skilled labor in the oil market. So it's not just a matter of flipping a switch and saying, hey, let's produce that oil. It takes years and years to assemble this equipment and the personnel to build a facility, to get it start producing, and then to ramp it up to a significant level of production. And in terms of the oil that we believe is actually out there, okay, let's say there's 1 billion barrels of oil to be had in Anwar.
Okay.
Now, worldwide consumption is 31 billion barrels a year.
Now, they said there's 10 billion to 16 billion.
Okay. When they make those kinds of estimates, there's actually a whole range of probabilities associated with that they never bother to tell you about. So the 16 billion is probably what they call a P50 estimate. It's got a 50% probability of being that much. And the 10 billion barrels, we don't know because they haven't told us, but let's say it's a P90 estimate. Let's say that they think that's 90% probable. The U.S. consumes, just by itself, 21 million barrels of oil a day. So how far does that take us? It doesn't take us very far. If we can do a 15 or a 17% reduction in imports, well, that's terrific. But two-thirds of the oil that we consume is imported.
Right.
So does that get us off the hooks of depending on foreign sources? Absolutely not. Not even close. In fact, there's nothing that we could do in this country that would completely eliminate our dependence on foreign oil. Can't do it.
I've also seen numbers like $150 barrel of oil.
Sure.
Because of terrorist activity.
This is what I was alluding to a few minutes ago. You know, allow for an effective terrorist attack. Let's say a successful attack on Saudi Arabia's refinery at Ras Tanura. If that were successful, it would easily throw the global cost of oil to $150 a barrel, and it would do it in a heartbeat. It would do it in a single day's trading.
Okay, so you don't see that as an unrealistic way out left field scare tactic number?
Absolutely not. It could happen today. It could happen tomorrow.
Okay.
You know, I mean, we're in an extremely. This is a problem. No one appreciates how incredibly tight and tenuous the situation is. We are absolutely on pins and needles here worldwide with global oil supply and demand. You know, it wouldn't take much to throw us into a panic state, and that's what happens. So, and that's what we saw happen right after Katrina.
Okay.
So, you know, that's why you get this sudden spike where the price of oil goes to 2x or 3x what it was. It's panic.
Chris, you got me so enthralled here, I forgot to mention your name a few times during our broadcast, but we've been extensively interviewing Chris Nelder. He's a senior analyst of Energy and Capital, also a party to greenchips.com.
Greenchipstocks.com, yeah.
Greenchip Stocks?
Correct.
Greenchipstocks.com. So if you'd like to get further information from our very special guest, Chris Nelder, as a senior analyst, how can they find your website there, Chris?
Energyandcapital.com or greenchipstocks.com. And for those who are interested in my personal musings, I repost my articles and some of my other stuff with my own private blog, which is getreallist.com.
Well, in closing, any thought that you'd like to summarize with? We've covered pretty much extensively your thoughts on this peak oil concept, as well as I tried to ask you questions that would trip you up, and you did a fine job of totally tripping me back. So,
well, I'm glad we got through it. I'm working on a book right now that'll hopefully be out in the fall. Can't tell you the title yet because I don't think it's settled, but I'll certainly make sure that we get a lot of good press out about that. So the book will talk all about all these different energy alternatives and my view of them and what it looks like going forward. But as far as a message for the folks out there, something to take away, you know, what I encourage everybody to do is to look at their own personal energy consumption and ask themselves, what can I do about it? How can I bring my energy footprint down? You know, if I can drive or if I can ride a bicycle or take public transpo one day a week instead of driving, I have made a personal difference. And if I can buy food locally instead of, you know, something that's been shipped 3,000 miles across the country, I can make a difference. And so I really encourage people to look at their own personal energy usage and ask themselves, what can I do?
Well, a very charitable thought. I want to thank you very much for being our very special guest. This has been Chris Nelder, Senior Analyst of Energy and Capital, and also can be found on greenchipsstock.com. Chris, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Thank you. Well, that's pretty much it for our broadcast. I want to thank you for listening. Got into the deep meat of this energy topic all over again. It seems to be one, certainly, that we need to try to understand more fully as we go through the remaining part of the summer months and this heated summer driving season. I want to thank you for listening. This has been Ken Brown. Today was a good day. Tomorrow will be better. Take care, and thanks for listening, and bye-bye for now.